This is part five of the interview with Harold Kerr and Tom Zinn. Tom, let's go to Turkey. Why don't you tell us about the 5 years, was it,
that you spent in
Turkey?
Well, we left for Turkey in 1970. My wife and two children, my youngest son was just a year old. And we spent 5 years there. It was a two-year assignment, and it turned into five. And the assignment was to try to adapt a summer fallow system that was so successful in the mid-Columbia Basin of Oregon and where I was working in Gillam County to Turkish conditions on the Anatolian Plateau. I had about 8 million acres there. They were producing somewhere around 11 bushels, 9 to 11 bushel per acre of wheat. With the summer fallow system, we thought we could double that at least. We did find out through research while I was over there that adding fertilizer at the right time, and they had access to fertilizer, and then using herbicides for weed control at the right time, we could double the yield. If you added then the summer fallow system, which we talked about earlier, you could triple the yield. So we could go from 10 to 11 bushels to about 35 to 40. The nice thing about Turkey and the Anatolian Plateau and why we thought we could do that is if you overlay the weather data from Pendleton, Oregon, like temperature per month, rainfall, moisture, transfer evaporation rates, it almost is a direct overlay to Pendleton, Oregon, to on the Anatolian Plateau or to Ankara, Turkey. So we thought that we could successfully develop a tillage system that would work. The biggest challenge we had was soils over there, which are extremely heavy in clay. You could just roll up the soil when it was wet in a ball or a plate-like or a bowl-like, fire it, and you had pottery. So that created some challenges in timing of tillage. But other than that, over that five-year period, we were successful. When we left, Turkey had been importing wheat every year. We had been given Turkey wheat through the what's called a PL 480 bill, and providing wheat for them for years. About 2 years after we left, they stopped importing wheat, and then they began to export a little wheat. They have never imported wheat since. Mm. So it was one USAID Rockefeller program that was very successful. And it wasn't just me. There was a team of people, had a weed specialist and another tillage specialist that worked for Rockefeller and myself, and then a person that developed extension pamphlets and taught extension agents how to teach farmers. So,
so did you have a leave of absence from the extension service?
Yes, I did. I had a leave of absence for 2 years. It stretched into five, and as that stretched out, I had agreed to get my degree during that period of time.
Or this was your master's degree?
My master's, yeah. Or when I got back, and so I asked the university in the fact that I had extended if I couldn't develop some research myself for my master's, because I wanted to get a master's of science in cereal production, because I thought I wanted to come back and work in cereal production somewhere in Oregon. They agreed to that, so I actually did my research first, and then when I returned in 1975, enrolled at OSU and got my coursework out of the way in about a year, and got my master's, was then transferred to the Dalles, or there was a position open in the Dalles, which was just really fit right up my alley. I keep thinking back about the time that I took my first job in St. Helens, which was in horticulture, and finally the university found a job that I thought maybe I was qualified.
Before you move on, your family, your wife and children, came with you to Turkey?
Yes, my wife and two boys. Like I say, my youngest boy was just 1 year old when we moved to Turkey, and we lived in Ankara, which is the capital. My oldest son was 2, and so we lived there 4 or 5 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You must have liked it. I mean, I'm looking around your home with the rugs and the photos. And
oh, we really enjoyed. We really enjoyed it. You know, we didn't have television there in Turkey in those days, and we did a lot of things with our children. It was kind of neat that you don't see now, but, you know, we read a lot of books, listened to a lot of music, and my wife and I did a lot of rug shopping on the weekends when I was home. I traveled out in the country quite a little bit. Our research plots were in five areas, which would be similar to counties in Oregon, maybe between 20 miles and 150 miles apart. So I was on the road quite a bit of the time, particularly during the season when you're plowing or seeding or whatever. Mm-hmm. The experience that I got was fantastic, and the education then coming back just really fit well for the job in Wasco County. Mm-hmm. And that job was, I was responsible for crops and livestock production in Wasco County. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Wasco County, I think it was the latter part of 76.
Mm-hmm. So you say they finally gave you the right...
finally found my niche, at least I thought I did. I have never regretted any position that I ever had or was assigned to, mm-hmm, with the Extension Service. And I learned so much in every position. It was just a wonderful, wonderful challenge and experience for me in all three of the counties. But that probably fit my education better than any position I had.
So what exactly was your title?
It was a livestock crops agent in Wasco County. Okay. At that time, yes.
So what kinds of projects did you work on?
Well, there were numerous projects. I had some research projects that I conducted in seed size for wheat, the larger size of seed, the theoretically the more production you'd get or the heavier production. And then a couple of other things I did that I think were significant in Wasco County was I ultimately got gained the trust of the wheat producers there and sent out a questionnaire asking them if they would please divulge their yield. I didn't want their name, but I wanted their yield and the area in which they were farming. I could figure out who was who, but that wasn't important. But what I wanted to do, and the variety of wheat that they were growing, what I wanted to do is put that all together and send out a report to all the ranchers to show them what varieties seemed to give the best yields. And so I remember imploring them to be honest about their yields, and you just had to accept that. And I think probably once they found out what I was trying to do after about the second year, it became really quite popular because they could see in their area if there was another variety of wheat that somebody else was growing and they knew that was in their area, it might be a lot better yield. And if it was on particularly 2 or 3 or 4 other ranches, it was a great help to the wheat producers. So those are some of the things that I recall that were quite involved. I conducted a wheat workshop, and I was thinking of about 3 counties then, Heppner and Gillum County and Sherman and Wasco. And good heavens, when we advertised that, we had people from both Washington and Oregon State, and it was quite an intensive workshop where we had the ranchers dissect a wheat plant and understand all of the parts of the wheat plant and why they operated. We had a wheat physiologist there and why they operated the wheat plant, how it grew, and then we went through the whole gamut of like use of herbicides and what effect that would have on, say, the coleoptile or the growing point of the plant at different stages and why you got injury in some and why you didn't in others. And it seemed to be real popular, I think, didn't it, Harold?
Excellent.
At a put together quite a workbook for them and really challenged them. I mean, they had to get in and they had to work. They had to think. It wasn't just sitting there talking to them. Mm-hmm. Had microscopes for everybody there at the tables, and they were kids back in school. And mm-hmm. at first they were kind of grousing about it, but once they got into it, they really seemed to get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, Harold, you were also in Wasco County?
Right. When I followed Tom. And that those are big feet to fill. Mm-hmm. I moved down there from Heppner to the Dalles to Wasco County.
What year was that?
Well, it must have been 1980. Mm-hmm. And the people in Wasco County love to say that they were a lot smarter than those in Morrill County because they got rid of me in less than 2 years. Yeah. And it took them 13 up in Heppner to get rid of me. So, but that led to an opportunity to come to Corvallis to be part of the administrative team. Mm-hmm. Wasco County was a fascinating place to work. As Tom was talking about the areas, it's not a huge area as far as acres of wheat, but there's really differences between the north end of the county, the middle of the county, and the south end, and huge differences in yield potential because of rainfall mm-hmm. and soil depth. Up in that Columbia District, up next to the Columbia River, as good as any wheat ground in Oregon, as good as anything up in Umatilla County. And then out south on the shallow, gravelly soils, it was a struggle to get a crop out there. Mm-hmm. But it was a very interesting place to work. And mm-hmm. I followed Tom as the livestock agent and the crops agent and also the staff chair. But I was there a very short time and I think was just beginning to be accepted by the growers when I mm-hmm. left. So.
Well, one thing I have to ask you about is the Rajneeshis. Were you there at
their hub? I was their county agent. I got a call from Sheila's husband. Mm. Wanted to talk about growing wheat back there on the.
Maybe we should say exactly who they were.
Ahmad, Sheila. Oh,
yeah, the Rajneesh Purim. They were bought this large block of land in southern Wasco County, and it had some pieces of ground that had been farmed through the years, but when they took it over, those pieces of ground had all grown up to weeds and rabbit brush. But there was a potential acreage there to grow wheat on. And the gentleman that I worked with he was a lawyer from back east, if I remember right, knew nothing about wheat. These guys are still alive, so I guess we can talk about them. But anyhow, I spent quite a little time with him, went through the whole process of equipment he needed and tillage and when to do it and what kind of seed to plant and how much fertilizer to use and what they needed to harvest. And we got all through and I realized I had skipped over weed control. And I said, oh, we got to back up a bit. I said, there's one area that is probably vital. I said, you plow up this desert ground and plant it to wheat and the weeds are going to come unbelievable. That all that seed's been laying there for years and when you disturb that soil, it's just going to be solid weeds, and these are the chemicals. Oh, he said, no, we don't believe in chemicals, he said. And he said, weeds won't be a problem. And I said, tell me how you're going to control weeds. He said, we got a lot of people here. He said, we'll pull the weeds. And thinking about people pulling all those weeds, and I said, you know, we've just wasted a couple hours of my time and your time because you're not going to get those weeds all pulled by people and you aren't going to grow any wheat unless you get those weeds out of there. So I left. And later that harvest time, they wrote a big story about this combine that they ran and it cut the weed and it took the weed and then the plant and then real wheat fell into the bin. And the writer said, we harvested all day and we got 50 bushel. And that sounded great to them, but that was a laughable statement to make because you should have harvested 50 bushel in 10 minutes.
Yeah, 2 acres.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was a disaster economically. The other instance I had with them, another person, part of their administrative group, came in the office one day and asked if he could use my phone. And I had a private office, and I said, sure, assuming he was making local calls. And walked out of the room and was out quite a while and happened to walk by the door and picked up on the conversation that he was talking to somebody in Portland. And I thought, I didn't give him permission to make long distance calls. Mm-hmm. So I walked in, I said, your time's up. I said, I didn't give you permission to make long distance calls to Portland. And he said, what do you mean? I said, hang up the phone, you're done. And about that time was when they were accused of poisoning the salad bar at the Portage Inn. And for a little while, I thought I might be on their list, but I never heard any more from them.
Yeah. So they left the area, though, soon.
They were still there when I left.
You didn't drive them out?
I didn't drive them out, no. They I don't know what all happened that they left, but the Roshanish moved to India, I guess, and anyhow, it fell apart.
I think the whole thing, it was initiated finally. There was a lot of fear down in the South County of them by a lot of residents. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back was when they poisoned a salad bar at the Portage Inn. And
it was in the Dalles, right?
Yeah, that's the Portage Inn in the Dalles, where the judge and commissioners were having a meeting, I guess, or ate there. And they made a number of people, I don't think anybody lost their life, as I recall, but they made some people very, very sick. And I think it was botulism was the poisoning agent. I'm not positive about that. But from there, I think it finally got the support of the state, and it went downhill.
Mm-hmm. You were asked earlier, Elizabeth, about corporate farms in Morrow County, and I didn't give you a complete answer there. The county judge that had challenged me about being wet behind the ears called me up one time, and he said, people are concerned that you're spending too much time with the corporate farms. And I said, Paul, I treat those people the same as I do the smallest wheat farmer in the county. I said, I answer their questions. If they want me to go to the field to look at a problem, I do, but I do the very same thing for in the individual family wheat farm. And I said, I can tell you that they honestly don't get the disproportionate amount of my time, but I appreciate you asking, because what was the lady that wrote Silent Spring?
Rachel Carson.
Rachel Carson. That book had come out, and he sent that book over to me. He said he wanted me to read that, and wanted to know if I agreed or disagreed with it. And so I wrote him back a 2-page response and telling him how I didn't discriminate against them just because they were big, but I certainly didn't give him any favors either. Mm-hmm. Seemed to satisfy him, and I felt comfortable with that. So when the Roshanish called, I thought, well, they're a landowner. They have a right to my services. Yeah. So.
Hmm. Okay. So you said you went to Wasco County following Tom. And so, Tom, where were you? Where did you move to?
Where did you move to? At the time, Extension was looking for a supervisor. There was a position open. And so I applied for that and ultimately was selected as a supervisor for area supervisor for a number of counties. And so I moved from Wasco County or the Dalles to Corvallis 4 days before. You know, it seems like 4 days before things happened to me all. The October 12 windstorm. And I moved to St. Helens October 8th, and 4 days before Mount St. Helens blew, we moved into our house on Roosevelt in Corvallis. So the omen wasn't too good. And so I became a part of administration in Corvallis at the time. And then
you said you were a supervisor. Could you explain that? In the district system.
Yeah. At that time, we were in charge or had administrative responsibility to a number of counties. There are 36 counties in Oregon, and they were divided up. I think there were 4 supervisors. And so we didn't have 9 counties. I think I think at the time when I first came to Corvallis, I think I had the administrative responsibility for 7. And basically our responsibility at that time was working with the chair agents who had the administrative responsibility in each county, and working with them if there were issues, problems on budgets, evaluating them, come evaluation time, making sure they evaluated their staff, and as administrative support to the county staff, and specifically the county staff chairman. Did I miss anything there, Harold?
Well, we were responsible for hiring new agents.
Right, and hiring faculty members. We were part of a group, later on when we reorganized, but we were part of a group that did the hiring and decided what positions would be replaced if there were vacancies, etc. And responsible for taking the candidates to the counties, having the counties look the candidates over, interviewing the candidates, and just basically everything that had to do with administration and as Harold says, hiring staff. Mm-hmm.
Had there been a reorganization?
Well, in 1982, the Extension Service was reorganized.
Which happened about every 10 years.
Yeah, which seemed to happen about every 10 years for some reason. But in the reorganization of the Extension Service put us in our position. There were three of us at the time that were supervisors, four, I guess, and they were going to make associate directors to the director and have an administrative team, which would be comprised of the director and the four associate directors. And they were responsible at that time then for total budgets, statewide, faculty on and off campus, as far as decisions were concerned, and what positions you replaced. And the directors then had, associate directors also had responsibility for recruiting staff, filling positions, and had the responsibility, again, to serve, like the supervisors, a certain number of counties. So we had a position vacant at the time after we reorganized. And so Harold applied and was accepted. And so that's how he got to Corvallis. I think it was 1982 when he came down as associate director.
You said there were four? So
there were three, worked with the counties, Tom and I and Alberta Johnson. Okay. And then Norm Getzey was associate director and responsible for this specialist on campus.
Okay.
And so he worked with the department heads a slightly different way than we worked with the staff chairman, but basically he was responsible for all of the specialists on campus.
He worked through the department heads with the specialists, and then as administrative team, then the four of us made decisions on budgets and evaluation. Department heads evaluated the faculty, but Norm had a significant input on the faculty. So we had a representative for on campus and off campus.
Mm-hmm. So you each were then, the two of you and then Alberta, you divided up the 36 counties?
We did.
And you each had 12?
We each had approximately 12.
We divided it a little different. I think at one time we had, I know when I had the metro area, that was a pretty good size area, but it was closer. And at one time I had just 9 counties, and the other two associate directors picked up the rest of the counties, and then we did some shuffling again, and it part of it you looked at where you had to travel, whereas Harold had probably the hardest traveling job was the furthest, because he had the outlying counties on the east side, the far east side, Malheur, LeGrand, Wallowa, so he had less counties than some of us at times, just because of the distance that he had to travel to get there.
So did you have some in the valley or some
in
the west and some in the east?
I had those. Actually, I don't know that I ever had less than 12. I had those 8 on the east side, and then I had Benton, Lane, Lynn, and Lincoln on the west side. So those were all, I didn't have to stay overnight. I could go to county and spend the day and get back. But when you went east, if you were planning at all, you tried to plan a whole week out there, because I said I could leave 5 o'clock from Corvallis to be in any county seat in Oregon by midnight, but it took all that time to get to Malau County. So,
So Tom, what were your counties then? You said the metro area.
Well, yeah, I had the metro area, I had Central Oregon, and I had some of the coastal counties.
Okay.
Then I had Klamath Jackson at one time.
And Lake.
Klamath Jackson and Lake. Deschutes, Crook Deschutes and Jefferson, and Douglas. I had Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas at one time. I had Astoria, Clackamas, Clatsop, Tillamook, and
Columbia.
I had most
back to Mount or St. Helens.
So. We traded around a bit from time to time because of differences in people's travel or schedule or other things that they might have to do. We brought in another associate director for a while when they pared down a business office, and he took over. A number of counties, and I can't remember what the assignment was, but I know I had every county in the state with the exception of the ones that Harold had in the Far East. I had at one time had been in every county for a while.
One of the unique things that we talked to, both of us talked about being hired by Frank Ballard and his team, when I got to Corvallis, the counties that I was assigned had 3 vacancies, and the traditional way to fill those was to take a candidate out, have him meet the local people, see the area, and have him be interviewed by a local committee, and then bring him back to Corvallis and interviewed by the formal committee that made the decision about hiring, subject to the local people accepting that person. And that was all kind of negotiated by the associate director. Well, when I saw that I had 3 positions and the policy was to take 1 candidate at a time, I thought, you know, this is impossible. I'm going to be on the road forever filling these 3 positions in Eastern Oregon. So I think I'm right that I instituted I had 4 candidates for 2 positions in Burns and John Day, Harney and Grant County. And so the Grant County position was temporary while the agent was on a sabbatical. And so somebody said, well, you can't take all 4 candidates in the same car. I said, well, I think I can. I said, I'm going to talk to them that they're not being evaluated while we're traveling. They can visit as much as they want to, talk about anything they want to, get acquainted. But I said the formal interviews start when we get to the county seat. That first trip, I picked up 2 candidates in Corvallis, 1 at the Eugene Airport, and headed over the mountain to Bend, and the 4th candidate had flown into Boise and rented a car and met us in Burns. And so we did our interviews in Burns and with the local people, and then we had 2 cars and 5 people, so I said, we got to rotate so everybody gets acquainted. So one of the candidates was from Iowa, and I said, why don't you drive the rental car and then the other 4 of us can ride my car. There were 4 of us. And so we went from Burns to John Day. Well, we got down the hill coming down into Canyon City, and this other car didn't come and didn't come and didn't come. And when we were up at the top of the hill, she was right behind me. And so finally I got concerned and turned around and drove back up the hill, and here she was coming, 15 miles an hour. She'd never been on a mountain like that in her life. Scared to death driving down that hill. Anyhow, she ended up getting the position in Grant County, and the girl that had flown in from Minnesota to Boise ended up getting the John Day position, or the Burns position. And then so I filled the other position the same fashion and did that for the 8 or 9 years that I was a supervisor. Never had a problem with it.
Well, he started something, and all of us did the same thing. We started, you know, when we advertised, and we'd advertise, and we'd pick out of the pool, we'd select what candidates we thought, whoever the selection committee was, which composed of people from the county and on state. And it was probably heavily loaded with county people and maybe a specialist and certainly us, one of us. And we'd put them in the car, and I would tell the candidates if they'd call, you know, this is going to be different for you because you're going to see your competition and ride with him and stay with him. And I remember a couple of candidates saying they'd never heard of a thing like this mm-hmm. in their life, but when they got through the process, they would say they learned so much, mm-hmm. and it was so much easier for them to accept maybe the fact that they didn't get the job because mm-hmm. they saw the candidate or they saw all the candidates and made judgments. In a case, and you know, occasionally that would work the other way because they thought, well, I was better than any of the three or whatever. Mm-hmm. But we used that, all of us. And on campus, that was just almost heresy. You know? We were heretics to do something mm-hmm. like that. Why, they would never let a candidate see another candidate. Mm-hmm. We kind of had to laugh, but it not only saved the state a lot of money, but I think that it had some real value in being able to have all of those candidates together, mm-hmm. see how they reacted mm-hmm. with one another, and see how they reacted, you know, and when it was their time to make a little presentation, which they had to do, and then they were mm-hmm. asked questions to see how they responded. We did take the candidates and individually questioned them, you know, the committee.
They were interviewed individually. But
yeah. But they all had an opportunity together where three of them might be sitting watching and the other one make a little presentation about themselves. Mm-hmm. So they could see, you know, they could judge themselves of what this candidate was like. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a world of difference, as you well know. You know, when you're interviewing people, mm-hmm. there's a world of difference between candidates. So. Mm-hmm. It really was a system that at that time worked well for us.
Worked mm-hmm. good. I had at least two instances through the years where the candidates would get me aside and tell me who I should hire,
yeah.
which I never expected that yeah. kind of, you know, but that was, they had this feeling, they got acquainted and, mm-hmm. you know, and they'd say, boy, so-and-so is the one you ought to get, you know.
And I would call the candidates that I had and say, you know, want to let you know, and I always told them that, you know, as soon as we make a decision, I'll call you in. I'll let you know, and I'll do the call and let you know. And like Harold said, on three or four occasions, I'd tell a kind of, they'd say, well, you know, I think you're right. You yeah. picked the best candidate, and it wasn't that person, you know, but they say, well, I can see why you picked him.
Yeah.
It kind of made you feel good, and like I say, occasionally you'd have somebody that thought that, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons, they were the best, and they might have been the most intelligent, but we always looked at people skills.
Those people are now ready to retire.
Yeah.
That's almost been 30 years since yeah. we started that. Yeah.
So you recruited nationwide yeah. for
yes.
these
yeah,
positions.
We did,
Oregon
yeah.
had a good enough reputation that you...
And had a system to contact their career counselors or whatever they were called yeah. on the campus and say, we have these vacancies in Oregon. Yeah. Most states did that.
Yeah.
And
we advertised in, I can't remember, 10 or 12 papers in and around the general area, Northern California, some in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. And then a position announcement went out to every extension service in every state. We interviewed some people from Alaska. And from Hawaii, I had a candidate from Hawaii that I took over to Central Oregon, and we interviewed, and she was a top candidate. She ultimately turned the job down, but coming back down South Santa Yam, it started snowing, and it was later in the year, like February, March, so it was a wet snow, and I mean, it was just coming down, and we stopped at a little restaurant just before you get to Sweet Home, a mountain house, I think it is, halfway house there. And she says, oh, stop, please stop. And so I thought, oh, gosh, something's wrong. And I thought, well, no, maybe they want to go to the bathroom or something. And the mountain house was open. So I pulled in there, and she got out. And I was just flabbergasted because they just finished their interview, and she had some pretty nice clothes on. And there was about 5, 6, 7 inches of snow on the ground. She just fell down and started making the snow angel. And I said, what are you doing? And she says, I'm sorry. She says, but I've never seen snow before. She says, I'm from Hawaii. She says, I haven't. I said, well, they have snow in Hawaii, don't they? Well, not where I live. I've never seen snow. She just stood out there and, you know.
Yeah.
You learn so much about every individual from, you know, all over the United States. Mm-hmm. It was interesting and mm-hmm. exciting.
Mm. In your work, what percentage of time did you travel? I mean, you were away from home quite a bit, it seemed, or not?
Yeah, as associate director, yeah, I never stopped to figure out how much time it was, but, you know, like I say, when I went to Eastern Oregon, I tried to schedule so that I either visit all the counties or spent time in the county where there was a personnel problem or something like that, or a budget problem, and tried not to run over on Monday and come back on Wednesday and then have to go back Thursday. I tried to get more done in one trip. I was thinking this morning that in those 30 years of driving over the mountain and through the gorge, I never looked at a weather report, never considered the weather as whether I should go or not. Chained up twice in 30 years. One time because a Forest Service rig stopped in the middle of the road because he spun out, and I was still going, but I had to stop. I couldn't get around him. And I embarrassed him, and he put my chains on for me. The other time, I had a set of chains that I'd never put on, and I was trying to get over Mount Hood, and it was slick, and I hadn't spun out, but I felt like I could. And so I stopped and put these wire chains on. I didn't go 5 miles, and one of them come off and wrapped around the rear axle, and the other one finally broke, and I thought, well, I'll just leave those on there till I get to Madras. I'll take them off, and so that was the only two times I chained up in 30 years, and now I don't think I approach it quite the same way.
Well, we did spend a lot of time on the road, and sometimes you kind of tried to evaluate that, boy, you know, that's your time utilization may not be the best in the world, but in trying to service those people and service them as far as from an administration standpoint and make those county agents and our faculty and our chairs feel that they weren't, you know, that we did care about them. And although we were in Corvallis, we were out there. I think we made a special effort during that era to make sure that they knew that we were there for them and in support of them. We did spend a lot of time on the road, and I can remember a number of times, you know, raising a couple of little kids, and my wife was a teacher coming home, and she was saying, "Boys, I'd like to have you meet your new dad." But like Harold, you know, if you're out and you're particularly on the east side, and you know you got to do something on Thursday, and you're all through somewhere else on Tuesday, you're not going to want to turn around and come back to Corvallis and then beat the highway up going back over. And there have been a couple times when Harold and I had to go different places, so we took two cars. And we had a couple of races going up over South Santa Am. He never won one
cheated,
of them.
He cheated, he beat me.
But, yeah, we did spend a lot of time on the road.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about Alberta? I mean, in the position of women in the Extension Service. Was Alberta Johnston, was she the first woman in a high position in Extension Service?
I don't think so. We had, well, they had an organization when Harold and I were chairs, and when we were in when he was in Prineville and Heppner and I was in St. Helens, where they had a man supervisor and a woman. And this was kind of an interesting scenario compared to now, but in, quote, those days, back in the 60s and 70s, they had a woman who supervised the home economist, and if the 4-H agent was a woman, then that woman supervised her probably. So never did the men supervise the women, never did the women supervise the men. So when the administrative staff from Corvallis went to Burns or Bend or wherever, they went as a man and a woman team. And the woman would go in and sit down and visit with a home economist and do whatever they needed to do. And the other supervisor would go in and sit down and visit with the chairman agent or the other agents. And so I would say that at that time, that was probably the first women in administration that we had. My guess is around the 60s, the beginning of the 60s, when they had that split between the supervisors, one handling the men and the women. And then they moved over to I think Alberta probably was the first female
to supervise
supervisor without having a, yeah, all programs without mm-hmm. having a male there to supervise the male part. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to laugh about that nowadays, you know, that would never have flown 100 mm-hmm. years ago, but I guess that was the only way it would have worked, mm-hmm. You know, in the 60s too.
Alberta and I were assigned to meet with two federal extension people. That's a small staff in Washington, D.C., but they kind of view themselves as overseers of the mm-hmm. state organizations. And these two guys came out, and Alberta and I were chosen to meet with them. And they made three or four references to Alberta supervising the women. Or we told them about our county breakdown, and they'd say to Alberta, well, who supervises the ag program in your counties? And she said, I do. And I think she said that at least twice, and I supported her at least mm-hmm. twice. And this guy still was saying, well, who's the ag supervisor in this county? And mm-hmm. I said, Alberta is. How many times do we have to tell you that? And they never did understand it, I don't mm-hmm. think. They couldn't get used to that idea. So apparently our old system was more common nationwide than the new one we had. But, yeah, one of the things we did each spring, we traveled together as a threesome and evaluated the staff chairman and listened to the agents, staff chair's evaluation of the agents. Mm-hmm. And we did that as a team. And so we traveled together. We were out for a whole week, probably 2 weeks to get it done. And we became good friends, mm-hmm. traveled well together, mm-hmm. and have a lot of stories that the three of us shared that probably ought to stay in that car.
Well, we did, and we did have a very good working relationship and a good supportive working relationship among us. And you kind of had to. I mean, you were there. You were in the box, and, you know, unless you wanted out, no one was going to let you out of the box. So you made it work, but it wasn't a case where it didn't work for us. No. We were very fortunate having personalities that we did with Harold and Alberta and myself.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there are some stories that are kind of funny, but if Sue's going to type this up.
I think she thought of us as her boys.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a break. So this is the end of part 5.